reading some time ago a short story by an American author. I forget who it was, but it was quite interesting in this way from this point of view. The story was about a woman who was a student of the occult and the mystical and all that sort of thing, and the esoteric, and she had become quite well known, and she started her own little movement, and it had grown to a big movement, and there were thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of followers. This was in America, of course, not in this country. And they all had checkbooks, and lavish contributions started pouring in. So she had a dream, a sort of wish that she wanted to fulfill. She had the idea of a beautiful temple. She wanted to build, as the headquarters of her cult, a beautiful temple. And she saw it all quite clearly in her mind. There's a flight of beautiful marble steps going up to a beautiful marble portico, and inside there was a multicoloured glass dome and multicoloured light streaming down, and there was she on a throne, you see, a white alabaster throne in a rainbow robe and a golden crown on her head, and all the faithful followers around, you see. So she saw this quite clearly, and being a woman, not only of occult knowledge and mystical knowledge and esoteric knowledge and all that sort of thing, but a very hard-headed, practical business woman, as one has to be to run a thing of this sort, she got things moving. She got things really moving, and she had the foundation stone laid. And as I've said, this after all was in the United States of America, and within about 6 months the whole thing was there in all its glory, and she was installed as the high priestess, and yes, she wore the rainbow robes and the golden crown, and there were all the faithful flocking around her, and that was that, or she thought that was that. Now, not very long afterwards, she had a letter from someone she'd never heard from for years, a sister. Apparently their ways had parted, and when she started going all occult and mystical, her family, as often happens, rather sort of disowned her, and she hadn't had any contact with them or with her sister for years. So anyway, a letter came from her sister, and the sister wrote, "You might be sorry to hear that our mother died not so long ago, and the house has been sold up, and I've been clearing out, and in one of the attics I found some of your things. I thought you might like to have them, and I'm sending them by separate post." So after a few days along came a parcel, and there were some children's books, little picture books, which had belonged to this woman when she was a girl. So the story goes that she opened this parcel, and right on top there was a picture book. And the picture book, the title or the heading of the picture book was Mabel in Fairyland or something like that. And on the front cover there was a beautiful picture of a white marble temple. And there were three marble steps going up, and then there was a beautiful marble portico, and there was a rainbow-coloured dome, and there was a little girl standing on a marble throne in a rainbow robe and a golden crown surrounded by crowds of fairies. So the moral of the story is supposed to be that all her life and all her work as the leader of this group on this movement was just the fulfillment of this wish which she'd formed when she was a little girl to be this sort of fairy queen-like figure. So this is just an illustration. This shows how at bottom very often we don't change. There may be peripheral changes. We may grow in knowledge and experience, in contact, we may travel widely, but just as this woman was at heart still that little girl craving to be the fairy queen, in the same way we remain very often deeply and even dramatically, even sadly conditioned by our childhood, our infantile past. So any change that takes place is usually comparatively superficial. We may say that, well, we take to Buddhism, we take refuge in the Buddha, but the change is superficial. It isn't usually very deep. But the Buddha's experience of enlightenment wasn't like that. The Buddha's experience of enlightenment didn't represent just a little peripheral change in him, a change just on the surface. It was something much deeper, something, in a way, much more dramatic than that. More like the change which takes place as between two lives. When you die to one life and you're reborn in another, and there's a great gap in between. The enlightenment experience is more like that. It's more like, we may say, death. In fact, in some Buddhist traditions, enlightenment is called the great death. Because when you're enlightened, that's where everything of the past dies. Everything is annihilated in a way, and you're completely reborn. So in the case of the Buddha, we may say Siddhartha dies. Not that Siddhartha is changed, or that Siddhartha is tinkered about a bit with, and sort of patched up and improved, and revised edition issued. No, Siddhartha dies. Siddhartha is finished. Siddhartha dies, as it were, at the foot of the Bodhi tree. He's finished there. And the Buddha is born. The Buddha comes into existence, or appears, only after the death of Siddhartha. We say the Buddha is born, but it's not really even like that. At that moment, when Siddhartha dies, the Buddha is seen as having been alive all the time, as we say. But when we say all the time, we really mean above and beyond time, out of time, altogether. Now, to come back to another very important reflection of Buddhist thought, and even of metaphysical thought in the West, time and space are not things in themselves. We usually think of time and space as things in themselves. We think of space as a sort of box within which things move about. We think of time as a sort of tunnel along which things move. But they're not really like that. Time and space are really forms of our perception. We see things, we perceive things under the form of time. We perceive them under the form of space, and so on. And things, when we see them, or phenomena, when we see them through the spectacles of space, through the spectacles of time, when we experience them through these dimensions, then we speak of these things as phenomena. And these phenomena make up the world of relative existence, of conditioned existence, or what Buddhists call the samsara. But when we enter this other dimension, when we enter the dimension of eternity, then we go beyond time and beyond space. And therefore we go beyond phenomena, which are only realities as seen under the forms of space and time. So we go beyond the world, we go beyond samsara, and in the Buddhist idiom we enter nirvana, or in the Hindu idiom we go from darkness to light, from the unreal to the real, from death to immortality. Now often enlightenment is described as awakening to the truth of things, described in terms of knowledge and vision of reality, seeing things as they really are, not as they appear, seeing things in their truth, seeing things free from any veils, free from any obscurations, seeing them without being influenced or affected by our own assumptions, our own psychological conditionings, just seeing them with perfect objectivity as they are. Not only seeing them, but if you like, becoming one with them, becoming one with reality, or one with the reality of things. So the Buddha, the one who is awoken to this truth, the one who, as it were, exists out of time, in this dimension of eternity, may be regarded, therefore, as reality itself in human form. The form is human, but the substance, if you like, is reality itself. And this is what is meant by saying that the Buddha is an enlightened human being. The form is human, there's a human form, but there isn't the ordinary conditioned human mind. In the place, as it were, if we can use such an expression, in the place, as it were, of the conditioned human mind, with all its prejudices and preconceptions and limitations, in the place of that, there is reality itself, or the experience, or the awareness of reality. Therefore, we say that the Buddha, the enlightened one, is reality in human form, or symbolizes or represents that in human form. So in this way we see that the Buddha is an altogether, we may say, distinct, indeed unique type of human being, not to be classified and not to be categorized. And this is the moral, as it were, of the story which we recounted the other day, of the Buddha's encounter shortly after his enlightenment with Upaka, the naked ascetic. Upaka, as you may remember, tried to categorize the Buddha as a deva, a yaka, gandhapa, even human being, but the Buddha repudiated all that and said that inasmuch as he had transcended all those conditionings, all those psychological conditionings on account of which he might have been called a deva or yaka or gandhapa or human being, he was simply a Buddha, one free from all those conditionings. And the same idea we find expressed in the first verse of the Buddha Vagga of the Dhammapada, where the Buddha says, whose conquest is not to be undone, whom not even a bit of those conquered passions follows, that enlightened one whose sphere is endless, by what path will you trace him, that pathless one? So the Buddha is a pathless one. The Buddha doesn't go on any particular path. There's nothing by which he can be identified, nothing by which he can be tracked or classified or categorized in any way. Often we find that people want to classify you, they want to categorize you. And I remember when I was in India, one of the first questions that I was always asked anywhere by anyone was, what is your caste? Especially in South India, this is the first thing that they want to know about you. Are you a Brahmin? Are you a Kshatriya? Are you a Shudra? Are you anything else? What is your caste? And if they don't know that, if they can't classify you or categorize you according to class, they don't know what to do with you. Or according to caste, they don't know what to do with you. They don't know how to deal with you, don't know how to treat you, whether they can take water from your hand or not take it, whether they can get to know you or not, or whether you might marry their daughter or not. All these things are very important. And just the same in this country, though here we're not so direct. In India, I've often been stopped in the road by someone just passing by and he says, what's your caste? Without any sort of preamble. But in this country, people are much more indirect in their approach. But they're trying to worm out of you the same sort of information. They want to know, really, what sort of job you've got. They've had to work out your income, maybe, from that, where you live, where you were born, where you were educated. In this way, by taking these various readings, as it were, these sociological readings, they can gradually narrow down the field, and then they've got you just there. You are this, you are that. And then they feel that you're nicely, neatly pigeonholed. But you can't do that with a Buddha. You can't even really do it with an ordinary human being, not really. Though you can try and even succeed to a great extent, but with a Buddha you really can't do it. A Buddha is one whom you can't pin down. You can't say he's this, you can't say he was that. But people like to try and classify and categorize even the Buddha, just as Upaka did. He wanted to know, he wanted to pin the Buddha down, whether he was a deva or yaka or gandhava or human being. And when he found he couldn't pin the Buddha down, the Buddha refused to be pinned down, he repudiated all those categories, then Upaka just didn't know what to do. And according to the account, he just shook his head and said, well, it may be so, and he went away. That was his reaction, because he couldn't classify, couldn't categorize, couldn't pin down the Buddha. So that's what is meant when we say, in the words of the Dhammapada, that the Buddha cannot be tracked. He doesn't leave any trace. He's the pathless one. Just like the bird going through the sky. The bird doesn't leave any track in the sky. And if you try to track a bird by following its path in the sky and looking for signs that it has left in the sky, then you would have your work cut out, as they say. So it's just the same with the Buddha. You can't track him, you can't trace him, because he belongs to a different dimension, the transcendental dimension, dimension of eternity. And the same idea is expressed in the Sutta Nipata, where the Buddha says, there is no measuring of man one to the goal, whereby they'd say, his measure so. That's not for him. When all conditions are removed, all ways of telling are removed, when all psychological conditionings are removed in a person, then you've no way of accounting for that person. And this is what the Buddha is like. And the same sort of idea is expressed more abstractly in four out of the list of 14 inexpressibles, as they are called. We won't go into all of these now, but these four positions are whether the Buddha existed or would exist after death or not, or both or neither. And the Buddha was very often asked this. For some reason or other, some of the ancient Indians had a real thing about this. And they often used to come to the Buddha and say, please tell us, when you die, will you go on living or not? Or both, or neither. So the Buddha always used to repudiate all these four. And he would say, it is inappropriate, it is inapplicable to say of a Buddha that after death he will continue to exist. It's also inappropriate to say that after death he will cease to exist. It's inappropriate to say he will continue to exist and cease to exist. And it is inappropriate to say he will neither continue to exist nor cease to exist. All these are quite inapplicable and quite inappropriate, because, he went on to say, even during his lifetime, even when he sits here in a physical body, the Tathagata of the Buddha is beyond all your classifications, beyond all your categories. You can't say anything about him. The Buddha is the person about whom you can't say anything, because he doesn't have anything. He isn't anything, in a sense. And this is why in the Sutta Nipata again there's an epithet of the enlightened beings, Akinshana, which is usually translated as man of naught, one who has nothing, because he is nothing. And therefore you can't say anything about him, which is very tantalizing for the human mind. We find, again, that many of the Buddha's disciples gained enlightenment by following his teaching, gained individual emancipation, but they still seem to have felt that there was something very mysterious about the Buddha himself, something they couldn't quite understand, something they couldn't quite fathom, something beyond them, even though they were themselves emancipated, even enlightened. And there's a story about Sariputra in this connection, which is typical. Sariputra was once in the presence of the Buddha, and he said to the Buddha, out of his excess of faith and devotion, he said, Lord, I think you are the greatest of all the enlightened ones who have ever existed, or will exist, or who exist now. I think you're the greatest of them all. So the Buddha was neither pleased nor displeased by that. He didn't say, well, what a marvellous disciple you are, and how wonderfully well you understand me. He said, well, he just asked a question. He said, Sariputra, have you known all the Buddhas of the past? So Sariputra said, no, Lord. And then he said, have you known all the Buddhas of the future? No, Lord. Do you know all the Buddhas that now are? No, Lord. Then he said, do you even know me? And Sariputra said, no, Lord. And then the Buddha said, that being the case, that being the position, how is it that your words are so bold and so grand? So this shows that even the enlightened disciple, the wisest of the disciples, like Sariputra, didn't fully understand, didn't succeed in fathoming the Buddha. And therefore we find that after the death of the Buddha, this feeling or this attitude on the part of the disciples that the Buddha was unfathomable, that even though they were enlightened, presumably just as he was enlightened, they couldn't really understand him at all, couldn't fathom him at all, this found expression in a list of 10 powers and 18 special attributes which they built up and which they attributed to him, just to mark him off, as it were, from all the other just merely emancipated and enlightened disciples. We're not going into that now, however. But what we are concerned with and what is significant is that this all crystallized eventually into a very important distinction made with regard to the Buddha. And that's the distinction between what came to be called his rupakaya, his physical, phenomenal appearance, and his dharmakaya, his true form, his essential form. Rupakaya literally means form body, and dharmakaya means body of truth or body of reality. Rupakaya is the Buddha as existing in time, and dharmakaya is the Buddha as existing out of time in the dimension of eternity. And it's the latter, the Dharmakaya, that is the real body. And this is clear, for instance, from the Buddha's admonition to Vakali. There's a monk called Vakali, who was very, very devoted to the Buddha. So much so he used to go about, he used to follow the Buddha around just looking at him. He was so fascinated by the appearance and the personality of the Buddha, he just used to spend all his time just sitting and looking at the Buddha, or following him around and just looking at him. He didn't want any teaching, he didn't have any questions to ask, he just wanted to look at the Buddha. So one day the Buddha called him and he said, "Vakali, this physical body is not me. If you want to see me, see the Dharma, see the Dharmakaya, see my true form." And we're told Vakali afterwards meditated upon this. And the same point of view is found in two very famous verses of the Diamond Sutra, one of the most important of all Buddhist texts, where the Buddha says, to Subhuti, he says, "Those who by my form did see me, by my physical appearance, and those who followed me by a voice, wrong the effort they engaged in, me those people will not see. From the Dharma should one see the Buddhas. From the Dharma bodies comes their guidance. Yet Dharma's true nature cannot be discerned, and no one can be conscious of it as an object." So most of us, like Vakali, try to see the Buddha in, as it were, the wrong way. Not that we should ignore the rupakaya, the physical body, the form body, but we should take it as a symbol of the Dharmakaya, the true form and the true body. The Buddha as he is above and beyond time, in eternity as it were, in his ultimate essence. But we must confess, we must admit that the word Buddha itself is very often a bit ambiguous. Sometimes when we say the Buddha, we mean the historical figure. For instance, we say that the Buddha spoke Magadhi. Well, here, obviously, the Buddha means the historical figure, Gautama the Buddha. But sometimes, we use the word Buddha to mean the transcendental reality. As when we say, for instance, "Look for the Buddha within yourself." When we say, "Look for the Buddha within yourself," we don't mean just Gautama the Buddha. We don't just mean Siddhartha. We mean the eternal, the time-transcending Buddha nature within ourselves. Broadly speaking, we may say that the Theravada school today uses the word Buddha more in the historical sense. But the Mahayana, especially Zen, uses the word Buddha more in the spiritual, more in the trans-historical sense. And for this reason we find that very often, though rather wrongly, the Mahayana is accused of deifying the Buddha, of making the Buddha into a god. But this isn't really what happens at all, as I have had occasion to explain on quite a number of occasions. There is quite a lot which could be said in this connection on this particular point, but I think I need not go into that here this morning. I think from what I have said already, that the connection between the Buddha and reality, even the Buddha and God, should be quite clear. So let's just very briefly summarize the conclusions reached so far. Enlightenment, we may say, can be looked at from two points of view. It can be looked at from the point of view of time, from the point of view of eternity. It can be regarded as the culmination of the evolutionary process, a process which is carried on, a culmination which is reached through and by means of personal effort. But enlightenment can also be regarded as being a sort of breakthrough into a new dimension beyond time and beyond the evolutionary process. And in the same way, we can look at the Buddha in two ways, as Rupakaya and the Dharmakaya, as included in history and also as transcending history. And in the second case, when we regard the Buddha or Buddhahood as synonymous with reality, as occupying the dimension of eternity, as transcending time, think the Buddha figure becomes a symbol of reality itself, but not identical with God in the Western sense, because there are no theistic attributes, no question of creation of the world or anything like that, even though object of devotion. Now, before we close for the morning, or before we close this morning's talk, there's, as you may remember, a promise to be kept, and that is, what does the right angle represent, or the point at the right angle represent? We can call that point X. Perhaps there ought to be an X there just to indicate that. It should be pretty clear now what it represents. We may say that the point infinity is the rupakaya of the Buddha. Here's the evolutionary process, starting at zero, going up through points 1 and 2 and 3, and culminating in the attainment of enlightenment or Buddhahood, right at the top, at the point represented or marked by the sign for infinity. So that sign for infinity is the rupakaya of the Buddha. But in addition to the rupakaya, there is the dharmakaya of the Buddha, the Buddha as existing out of time, the Buddha as existing in reality, in eternity. And this is the dharmakaya. So dharmakaya, rupakaya. This is the evolutionary process within time. This is eternity. This is ultimate reality. So in relation to rupakaya, this is dharmakaya. What is the point here in relation to zero? In relation to the infinity symbol, rupakaya, it's dharmakaya. In relation to zero symbol, it's what Buddhism calls the Dharma Dhatu. Reality as supporting the whole phenomenal process. Reality as expressing itself, as it were, in the whole cosmos. And the common denominator, of course, of Dharma Dhatu and Dharmakaya, this is, we may say, Shunyata, Mahashunyata, the great void, great emptiness. So this point also represents that. In itself, it is Mahashunyata. In relation to infinity, it is Dharmakaya. In relation to zero, it is Dharma Dhatu. And that's perhaps as far as we need go for today.